Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everybody, to another edition of Jawanza for Life. I've got three letters to say, OMG, okay? Oh, my God, we've got a show lined up for you. Now, I say that all the time, okay? And I haven't let you down yet, and I'm not going to start today. Got a surprise for you, everybody. This is going to be a very, very powerful show, so you might as well get ready to get on the phone and call your friends and tell them to tune in to Jawanza for Life, because I've got a very, very special guest, and thank you so much for agreeing to be my guest today. I'm going to let my wife, Aquia Shepsnatere, just tell you a little bit about her.
Hello, everybody. Our very special guest today is Miss Sharon Brown. Miss Brown is a singer, songwriter, producer, and musical arranger and coordinator, and is especially known for her classical mega hit in 1982, I Specialize in Love, on the Profile and Virgin Records UK, and is still going strong.
Still.
Miss Brown, she won the Best New Female Artist of the Year Award from Cash Music Magazine in 1983, and has worked with a variety of artists in the music business. Miss Brown is now in the studio recording music along with a host of friends. She is also planning a trip to Kingston, Jamaica,
to write
new music influenced by the legendary reggae artist Bob Marley.
Yeah, man.
Ms. Brown has always remained focused on designing her music for the uplifting of all people. Welcome to Jawanza for Life.
Welcome, Ms. Brown.
Blessings, Jawanza. Blessings, Yvette. Wonderful
yes.
to be here with you.
Yes.
Thank you. It's
a
an
blessing
honor.
To have you here. By the way, that's a classic hit, baby, not classical.
Okay.
It was classic. It was a classic hit in 1982. And I'm sure everybody remembers I Specialize in Love. You danced to that song. You went to the club. You partied off of that song. And the singer of that song is my special guest today. Oh, what an awesome, awesome surprise. And, wow, I'm with my wife. I'm kind of mind blown, because it's not every day we get to talk to, people who... I mean, just had you when you, because when you grow up listening to music, I never thought that I'd be speaking to people that I dance to. You know, I dance to their music. So, Sister Sharon Brown, it's been a long time since I Specialize in Love, but I'm sure that the listeners out there remember that song. And I'm going to give the number here to the studio. So, if you'd like to talk to Sharon Brown, give us a call at 347-324-5727. That's 347-324-5727. Sister Sharon, what actually got you started in music? Because that was a smash. I mean, in 1982, that was a song that everybody was listening to. That's a song that was on every dance floor. I mean, what got you started in music? And when that song dropped and when that song hit, because I know everybody has expectations. You know, when they're in the studio recording the song, everybody wants a hit. Did you have any idea? Because you can tell oftentimes when a song is going to be good. It's like, I like that. I think that's going to be good. But two questions, first off. What got you started? And once having gotten started, did you think that it was your song, I Specialize in Love, was going to take off like that?
Okay, well... First of all, what started me in music was my dad. My father is a musician. My father was a drummer and a jazz musician. And he knew a lot of cats in New York City where I was, you know, born. And through my dad, I met a lot of musicians. I saw a lot of live performances by some very great performers and great artists of our time. Starting with the late, great Sammy Davis Jr. That was the first live performance I had ever seen in my entire life as a young child at the Apollo Theater, which, by the way, I lived right down the street from it. The Apollo mm-hmm. Theater was 125th Street, and I lived 129th Street. So, you know, the Apollo Theater was almost a second home with my dad. And then as I grew older, I would go on my own to see the Motown reviews and was inspired, and then I decided to try my hand at putting a singing group together at age 15, and we went audition for the Apollo Amateur Hour, and Honey Cole was the MC at the time. It goes to show you how far back this really goes.
Wow.
And the lucky stump that you, every performer would have to rub their hands on to wish you luck before you performed on the Apollo stage. I my fingerprints are there.
Okay.
And, my fingerprints are there, and my little group. I hate to say it, but our name, we had a really cute name. We were the Gaylettes, and there was two other girls. Yes, the Gaylettes. Now, back in the day, it was okay. Now we say it now, we have things attached to it. But, yeah, we were the Gaylettes, and we sang. And my favorite vocalist at the time was from the Motown family, which was Miss Mary Wells. And I just had a great, great love for Mary's voice. It was so unique. And the fact that I paid such close attention to her performance, her vocal performance, I dug deep into, well, who's writing the music and who's writing the lyric? And next thing I knew, I was all into the world of songwriting and producing, and all through Motown listening to the things that Berry Gordy was pumping out on a regular basis. Just took over the music scene. But that's how I got started with my dad, and it just progressed and progressed until here we are. And the other question you asked me was, what was it that, how I got started, and what else did you say, Juwan, to keep me on track here, sweetie?
You think,
know how
did you think, after having gotten into, because I was thinking, and I'm kind of moving ahead a bit, but, you know, everybody, when they go into the studio to record something, or even if, you know, they're just sitting down writing a song, you know, you sit back, you listen to it, and you think to yourself, you kind of have an idea, this could be a smash. I mean, did you have any idea?
No. I wish I had known. No, it didn't come like that at all. I thought that that deal was just, if someone said to me, it had my name on it, which was my second husband, by the way, I've been married twice, and my second husband and I had left Massachusetts and went into New York to start a life of our own, which I was thinking, you know, we just had a little boy, and our families weren't too happy about the union, so we wanted to start somewhere fresh, and we came back to New York, which was my home, but I had no idea that my husband had other plans. His plan was to find his wife a record deal, and so he was being... He was, you know, diligently searching the trade magazines, and he found the Backstage magazine and started reading and found an ad looking for a tall, black, willowy female, a tall, black female with a willowy voice. That's what the ad read. And my husband said, get out the car, call this number, this is you. I said, oh, no, that's not me. No. So I went, I made a call, and lo and behold, I was on the other line with Eddie O'Loughlin, the great dance disco producer that had already produced hits like for the Silver Convention and Carol Douglas with Doctor's Orders and Midnight Love Affair. He already had a few hits under his belt. So, you know, they wanted me to come in with my music. And at the time, I didn't have any music with me. I had to turn the car around and hit 95 North and get back to Massachusetts to grab up my music and my leather suit and my leather boots, because I wasn't prepared. So my husband turned the car around, and lo and behold, we grabbed the stuff. We went back. We met the producers and the management at the time. They had four songs. Specialized in Love was one of them. And the other two were Creedence Clearwater Revival, Down on the Corner, and Chuck Berry's C'est la Vie, another import from Europe called Love Don't Hurt People, and then I Specialize in Love. They had a four-song deal for me, and I didn't like any of the songs. I C'est la Vie by Chuck Berry, they had completely taken it away from what it was and tried to make it some sort of disco jam. And I thought that was, you know, as a songwriter, I just didn't kind of agree with it. The arrangements were not that great at the time.
Okay.
So I was kind of like fighting it. So I had no idea. When Specialized in Love, when they played that song for me, it was the most bubblegum music I ever heard in my life. Mm-hmm. I cried. I told my husband, I'm an artist. I'm a musician. I've gone to school. I'm paying dues. And come on, are you serious? I write better music than that. And I was just really, really reluctant about that song. But they kept saying, Sharon, just listen to Eddie O'Loughlin, and he'll guide you through this. Because I had jazz roots. I had funk roots. And I had I had already been on the road with Sly and the Family Stone and hanging out with Sly in New York and Junior Marvin, which is the, you know, guitar player from Bob Marley. I mean, I knew great musicians and people, and I had contacts, but I had no record deal. So my husband encouraged me to take this record deal and to sing the song. And the keyboard player from Chic, Andy Schwartz, he took the song. He said to me, don't worry, I'm going to rearrange it because, you know, we're trying to, you know, do the right thing here, make a hit. So Andy took the song, and he worked on it, and that did-did-did-did, when you hear that, that's Andy playing keyboards, and that was the signature. We didn't know at the time, but it became the signature. As soon as people in the club heard that signature, they were on the dance floor. It seemed to be some sort of a Pied Piper's calling, and it would just call you to the dance floor. And I thought it was fabulous when I heard it again. And so, you know, he and I went to the studio and, you know, tried to give the best that we could at the time. And I was going through some tremendous changes. So I had no idea it was going to be a hit, but I did know it was an opportunity to escape the struggle and the pain and the stress that I had been going through personally with my husband and having a little baby and not being situated anywhere and not knowing where I was going to eat or sleep because actually we were still living in the car. So I was under a lot of stress at the time, a lot of stress. So I had no idea, gave no thought to it being a hit. I just knew it was a good opportunity. And I loved singing, and the arrangement was nice. So I just went into the studio, just Andy and myself, and we closed everyone else out, and it was just us. We dimmed the lights, and he said to me, you know, just go for it. And I said, okay, whatever you feel, whatever comes to you, go for it. And that's what we did. And I did the performance. I left back to my struggle every day in life, and lo and behold, one day I'm sitting at a somewhere in Harlem at a Tupperware party, and it was Valentine's Day. I had gone with my family, and we were there and having fun and whatnot, and the radio was on, and it was on WBLS, New York's black radio station, and Frankie Crocker was on, and he said, we have something new for you on this Valentine's Day, a new Valentine's treat for you from a new artist named Sharon Brown. And the song is I Specialize in Love. And we all started to scream and shout. We had no idea. Told me the song had been released.
Wow.
So I didn't know until I heard Frankie Crocker introduce it on the radio. And then my management called laughing and said, surprise. And,
yeah,
you know, you're on your way.
That had to really blow your mind. I mean, just to hear yourself. Was that the first time you had actually heard yourself on the radio? I mean, because had you ever done any projects with anybody else, might have been doing background for somebody else or whatever. Was this your first solo? This was your actual first solo attempt at music?
No. I had a hit, a major, major underground hit in 1975 that 76 when I was on the West Coast when I was working with Norman Whitfield. I had written a song with my keyboardist from the band I had been in. Ronnie Bishop had bought me a piece of music that he had called Family Tree. And he had a beautiful melody, chord structure, and very few lyric, and brought it to me and said it had me all over it. He knew I could finish it because I had been intertwined at that time with Sly Stone, and everyone knew if you wanted to get some kind of funky track done, I could do it because I had a funky bone. That's what they always would say. That girl got a funky bone, and everything she's saying is funky. Everything, you know. But I did take a pledge to the funk long time ago, and it's surprisingly because I got a hit in dance music, and the producer Ed O'Loughlin, he had a hard time trying to keep me singing in the pocket, singing, you know, pop style. He used to call me prima donna. I never even knew what it meant when he used to say it. But he used to tell everybody, she's a prima donna. If we can just get her to stop doing those jazz riffs and stop and get that funk out of there and blah, 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 blah. They went on and on. And then finally, you know, I captured the pop sound. Mm-hmm. And, and it came out okay, but I still wasn't happy until the great DJ T. Scott got his hands on it, and he did the remix on it. And then when we heard the remix, we said, well, yeah, that sounds like, you know, it doesn't sound like anything on the radio, so, yeah, we might have a chance at that. You know, that's when it started, started to hit me, that because I knew they were passing the master tape around to some pretty, pretty talented people that had already a track record and a fan base. So by the time that record got to T. Scott, I was getting ready to say, okay, this is getting ready to go a little bit faster now. So you better get ready. We better get ready for this. And that's exactly what happened when they dropped that record. When Frankie dropped that record with T. Scott's on it, it was a wrap. That was February 14th. By the month of May, I had been already to Amsterdam and the country of Holland three times in that month. Three times. I had already been there because of the success of I Specialize in Love. And you have to also understand that I Specialize in Love did not originate here in America. It was an import, a British import. It was released in the UK first.
But that had to even be a transition, just going from the whole funk thing to pop, because, you know, funk is a little less, I guess, structured, shall I say, for lack of a better term. You know, I mean, I'm sure it's structured, but not, I mean, funk is kind of do your thing. You know what I'm saying? Feel what you feel and let it out. You know, with the pop, you might have to stay within certain boundaries. Was that difficult to just kind of hold back the natural inclination to be funky?
I cried like a baby. I cried like a baby. I cried, but, you know, I couldn't sleep. I couldn't sleep because, when the record hit, it was on every radio station. Every radio station, AM and FM, was playing the song. Everywhere I would go, I would hear it. Now, New York is my home. You can become a star in New York City and nobody else in the world know about it because there's enough people there to make you that way. You understand what I'm saying? They buy your music and they like it. You ain't got to go nowhere. Stay in New York. But unfortunately, that's not how it goes because the rest of the world follows what New York says. But I couldn't sleep. My husband wouldn't leave the radio on at night. And I'd go to sleep. I hear it playing. I wake up. It's playing. And it got to the point where I said, listen, I can't have the radio on when I'm trying to sleep, because see, now I'm gigging back to back every weekend. I'm out Wednesday. I'm out the door, airport, bag, shoes, makeup, you name it. We're out the door, you know. And then when I go to sleep, you know, back at home, I really don't want to hear the radio. So it got to the point where I just couldn't listen to it anymore because it was just saturated. It was just unphenomenal. I had no idea it was going to be like that, but it was a shock of my life. And then to see the power that the song had generated among people. I had did a gig in New York City at a famous club there, Bonds International, down on Broadway, 45th Street.
Okay.
And that was a big, big room, and it held, you know, at least 1,500 or more people. And, I mean, it was no tables and chairs, just space, and people were standing, you know, watching, you know, their artists. But I played there once with Delroy Morgan. I think he was a Caribbean artist that had a huge hit.
Yes, I think
it was called "I'll Do Anything for You." Yeah. And
I remember that. "I'll Do Anything for You." Yeah.
Yeah, he was there, and another girl that Curtis Mayfield had produced with his manager Marvin, Ava Cherry.
Okay.
And it was Ava Cherry. I think she started singing with background with Nikki Howard and Lupa Vandross. That's where she went and made her money and fame. But she did have a single out during the time when I had mine out. And we were doing the show, and it was fun. It was a lot of people, packed house. But I was asked back again by popular demand, but this time they brought me back to Bonds alone. And that was the first, very first time I'd ever seen thousands of people, you know, I mean, hundreds of people, I mean, just packed in one place, and there was a line from the ticket window, from the door, the entrance of the club, all along the New York City block, around to the next corner, with a police barricade. And I pulled up in the limousine with my husband, and I said, "Look at all those people. It's all the way down the block and around the corner. Look at all those people." And he smiles and says, "Yeah, they were all here to see you." I said, "Oh, my God, are you kidding me? All those people? Well, how many people are inside?" So when we get in, you know, they let us out, and, you know, they open the limo car and door, and all the people started screaming, and everything went in slow motion for me at that time, because I had never, ever, ever in my entire life, musical journey, generated that kind of love in one spot, that kind of power, that kind of energy. I just hadn't experienced it, and it was just mind-boggling. Mind-boggling. It was addicting. It would just grab the entire being, and you would have to slow it down and walk through, and they led me through, bodyguards and everything, through the back to the dressing room. And as I was on that journey, I looked to my right to see all the people that were in the audience, and I almost stopped breathing. I could not believe the mass people, the sea of people. I just could not believe it. And my husband kept saying, "And they're here to see you."
To see you. By the way, for those of you who are just tuning in, my special guest today is Sharon Brown. Thank God she's here. Author of the awesome, fabulous song, "I Specialize in Love." If you want to talk to Sharon, give us a call at 347-324-5727. That's 347-324-5727. Sharon, I know that that had to be addicting. I mean, because on that level, I mean, like, I remember when I'm in Richmond, Virginia now, but when I was in D.C., I used to do open mics at some of the, you know, the local clubs or whatever. A buddy of mine told me about the open mics. Said, "Man, come on, you can carry a note. You ought to come down here and try it. It'll be fun." So I went down there and tried it. Next thing you know, it was addictive. I was, like, down there every time that you're doing open, just somebody clapping for you, somebody appreciating what you're trying to do. You know, that is such a feeling of, you know, it's humbling to think that somebody would actually, you know, come to a club to hear you. You know, just to stop whatever they're doing just to hear you. That's a very humbling feeling. And I'm sure for you to have thousands of people, I mean, lining the block just to hear, and like your husband said, "And they're here to see you." That had to really humble you.
Well, it did. It really did. But I can tell you, at that moment, for any performer, I'm sure they all that have been successful have experienced that first moment. And but it's a moment that will define you, because it's all in how you channel that great ball of energy and the power that you have now seen that you are able to generate and you're in control of that, it's a very tricky, slippery slope at that moment because it can define you. Like the key word is it was a humbling experience. Well, in some cases, for other people, it won't be a humbling experience.
Gotcha.
The power, the feeling of power will become so great that it can almost turn, it can turn you into almost like the Hitler syndrome or the Napoleon Bonaparte or, you know, Julius Caesar or, you know, you would become quite powerful and, you know, dominating and, you know, what you do with that power, what do you do with it? You know, you can use it for good, you can treat people good, you can always make and dedicate every show that you do for the uplifting of people all over the world. It transcends gender, it transcends race, creed, and religion. It's a very powerful platform to be launched upon, and it can go two ways. It can be a very humbling experience, and then it can be very dangerous for the wrong spiritual being that gets that gift, gets that blessing.
I can imagine. People wanting to know, all of a sudden, people wanting to be your friend. Now you got hangers on, people that are, you know, tail kissers, and you know what I mean.
Even idolize you.
Yeah, idolize you. I mean, yeah, we'll do anything for you. Now you, all you got to do is kind of snap your fingers, and you got somebody at your beck and call. What do you want? How can I help you? People rubbing your hair, washing your feet. I mean, I can imagine that it can go to some people's head.
It has many. Many. Trust me,
wow,
I see stories. I've got stories, but I just won't do it. I won't tell.
Well,
but yeah, it can really change you.
Oh, I can imagine. And on top of that, to have money and riding in limos, you know?
So that's all well and good, you know, but that, you know, that's like what we did at hindsight. It's like playing follow the leader. I mean, in hindsight, I wouldn't have been going everywhere in limos and doing the do like that because all that comes out your budget. I'm not trying to, you know,
mm-hmm.
The game is called, you know, the music business. And in
mm-hmm.
business, you make money. And see, a lot of us are creative people. We have a hard time merging into the world of business, coming out of the world of creativity. Two different energies, two different places to dwell,
mm-hmm.
and to master that is just phenomenal. And the hip hop culture has just blown me away with so many young black thugged out dudes and women right out of the hood that actually studied the art of the business, the music business. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
They didn't necessarily have a degree in music. They didn't necessarily go to any college for music or study any theory whatsoever,
mm-hmm.
but had a passion for music and had a little talent to do what they felt, had their own
mm-hmm.
style, their own swag, and
mm-hmm.
But they studied the business. And,
right.
And my hats are off to these people because they, you know, did what they were supposed to do so that you can produce longevity instead of just producing music and just worried about your next hit, blah, 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 the next show. You're really trying to produce longevity, you know what I'm saying, because there's a big, big difference in having a hit record
mm-hmm.
and then having a hit career.
Hello.
Two different things. There are
mm-hmm.
many people here on this planet in this business that have had hit records. I mean, many of them. I've gone on YouTube and I've seen some of these songs out there. I never heard of the artist in my entire life. I mean,
mm-hmm.
there's so many people that have had records and we never saw them again or heard from them again. And whatever they did was it just turned to be a classic masterpiece. And we're cherishing it now on YouTube and
right.
you know, discovered now on YouTube. But there's many people that have made records that were meaningful and soulful or funky or whatever you have, but they didn't have a hit career. There's
and that's so interesting
difference.
Because when they're out there, excuse me for interrupting, when they're out there, you think that they're going to be around forever. And a person comes to mind, Terrence Trent D'Arby. I mean, when he was hot, he was hot. When he disappeared, he was gone. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, and others, not to just single him out, but I just use him as an example because many of us who are of the age that we can remember those, what's his name, Orange Juice, whatever his name was, who had that hit Walking in the Rain. I mean, he was out. When he was out, he was hot, but when he was gone, he was gone, you know? And so, I mean, just even for the artists themselves to, just like you said, know that there is a business side, and just your talent alone, just because you can sing or you can rap, you know, doesn't mean that you're going to be around here. There are a lot of people that can sing and rap and dance, I mean, but they're not making music today, but they were, once upon a time, they were sitting on top of the world. And I'm sure that yourself, having seen them come and seen them go, I mean, you have a lot of wealth of knowledge that you can pass along to these young artists just coming into the business, just to even if you could just talk about songwriting as a means of staying in the business, as opposed to, that's kind of behind the scenes. You have those that do write and perform, but that's a behind-the-scenes craft that can keep you getting paid for a long, long time.
Well, yeah, that's very true. But a lot of the creative youth right now, a lot of them have their heads pretty much clear, much clearer than my generation and the generation before, and because they have the tools now to be in more control of what they do and their product, the internet, for instance, because you don't have to adhere to the A&R department of a huge corporation that has all the money and the know-how and the machinery to make you a star, and you have to listen to what they tell you and dictate your future. With the internet now, you have the tools at your hand, at your fingertips, to do what you want to do, and you have distribution companies all over the internet and, you know, internet stores to sell your product. You can sell your product direct to your fan base. You can create your buzz. I mean, that's the new thing now. Justin Bieber is an internet star. That's where
okay.
he started, from the internet. Now he's physically traveling the globe to,
mm-hmm.
you know, bring to you what he bought to you through the internet.
Okay.
And so that's really, really where it is right now. If any artist is out there and feel like they're caught up in the struggle trying to do it the old-fashioned way, you know, the future is the internet for control of your product. When I was 19 years old and I had the honor of meeting Curtis Mayfield, who was very instrumental in developing me as a songwriter, because that's where it started for me when I was 19.
Mm-hmm.
And when I met Curtis, and Curtis was one of the most prolific songwriters that was deeply rooted into the struggle of black people and the
mm-hmm.
unification of Africa. And
right.
that was an early, early training ground for me. Who knew I was walking hollow ground? At that time at 19, I was just a fan. I was an absolute, true fan of a prolific and,
right.
and angelic voice of a person. I
mm-hmm.
was completely connected, but who knew when we connected that I was being groomed and educated in an art that would take care of me for the rest of my life, and that would...
Oh.
I would be able to manifest and leave a legacy to the seed after I'm gone. I mean, who knew? But it was my experience through Curtis Mayfield that I knew that the word was powerful. I knew that he would always say the best thing any man or woman could do in this world is to own as much of himself as he possibly could. Yeah, and that was told to me at the age of 19,
mm-hmm.
and it stuck with me. It made me gained the reputation in the industry as being a prima donna or of sorts, of being completely engaged in herself. I mean, narcissistic to the point where I had a vision, I had a sound, and I knew how to construct it. I knew I had the tools. I knew how to do that. And I just refused to let anyone dictate or put me in some sort of geometric shape that they felt I belonged in. I just fought it, and I refused. And because I did, I didn't eat as hearty as the other female artists that was there. I was before Beyonce. I was before a lot of the artists out there, the Rihanna and all of the Gagas and Madonna. I mean, Madonna did a gig for my team in the Village once before anyone knew who she was. We had my dad came. We had photographs of her, and she had a little black boots and a little funky skirt and black dancers behind her in the Village. And I was supposed to perform that night, but I didn't because the people that put the event on didn't have the money that was promised to pay me. So we didn't go on, but Madonna did. And then, you know, in hindsight, we saw that it was a ploy of her team trying to get her, you know, out there with my audience, because the whole gig had been, the whole gig had been advertised, you know, is that I was going to be there. So the joint was jumping. It was a lot of people. But when I got there, they didn't have my money, and my team said she's not going on. And that's exactly what they wanted to happen. They didn't want me to go on. So, you know, it's been a long, long, long journey. But I tell you that the Internet right now is a musician's friend. To be able to control your product, there are no more record companies, you know, that, you know, you can take your music and think you're going to get signed to and blah, blah, blah. And if they were, I wouldn't advise anyone to do that, you know, after what I've gone through with record companies and now that I know what it's like. I don't want anyone else to have that kind of power over me. I'm here to sing praises and help as many men, women, and children through sound, through the healing vibrations of music. And I try very hard to keep myself surrounded.
I'm sorry, go ahead. Ignore it.
I keep myself surrounded by...
You still there? Go ahead. Go ahead,
no matter. Go ahead. I keep myself...
Still there? Sharon?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Thank you, but ignore that. Now, would you not advise anyone, let's say, for example, somebody, they want to shop a demo? I mean, the traditional way is to just go about it by, you know, you send it to an A&R director. You're saying those days are gone. That would not be the way you would suggest them to go?
Well, again, I would actually try to, once you have your product together, you need to create a buzz around that product. And wherever you are, you create that buzz from where you are, your neighborhood and surrounding areas. You create yourself a buzz. You start to stockpile your own merchandise, your T-shirts, your hoodies, your ink pens, your mugs, your cups, whatever it is, and you get your own logo. You're going to brand yourself. You know, you get, these are the things you have, a lot of homework, a lot of preparation to do to become, you know, the product that you want out there. But desperation and empty bellies make people do a lot of things. You know, like Bob Marley, you know, the hungry man, you know. So there's a lot of trickery out there to watch out for. But I suggest and advise all the young people to control as much of their product and themselves as they possibly can in this game, because you can lose yourself very easily by being desperate and going, setting the wrong goal. Your goal, you know, why are you in it? You have to ask yourself like you would ask yourself in any job that you were going out to get, may it be Burger King or McDonald's, whatever job you're going to get, the first thing you need to say is, how is this job going to serve me? Because a lot of people take jobs and are miserable to no end, always complaining, or can't hold a job, or changing jobs all the time, and always complaining. And it would be so much easier if you were to approach anything you do and, you know, as a free spirit and say, well, how does this certain thing serve me? See, we seem to be afraid of actually saying something is serving you. But that's what it's all about. That's what it's about. That's everything that's put here for you is to serve you. You are the highest creation here.
Come on now.
And it was everything here has been here before you. When you woke up into consciousness, all this was here. Everything was here, already in place. So what do you do with that? You either become a part of that, or you take a paintbrush, so to speak, as a metaphor, and paint your canvas as you see fit.
Mm-hmm.
You are to paint happiness for you, paint your joy. You see what I'm saying? And connect with the magnificent beauty that's been presented to you when you woke up into consciousness. I mean, the heavens, the trees, the water, it's all in the water. Everything's in the water. And these things we take for granted. And being a New Yorker, I know we take it for granted because most people in New York City don't even see the sky. They never look up. They never look up. They're too busy, you know, scurrying. They don't even bother to look up to know that there's a moon at night and stars. Can't see them anyway with all the bright lights and Broadway. But
who are some of the other artists that you work with? I mean, you have been influenced by some people, and I can just tell by listening to you and the things that you're saying that you have woken up in consciousness. You know, that there's something that you heard along the way, and the light went off. You know, and as a result of that, you see behind the veil, so to speak. But who were some of the other artists besides Curtis Mayfield that you may have worked with that may have added to the person we know as Sharon Brown today?
Well, I have to give a lot of credit to, as a songwriter, it goes definitely to Curtis Mayfield, but as a producer, it goes to Norman Whitfield. Norman Whitfield is the man that gave me the knowledge and the tools to work with because I didn't have a studio. He did. But he would give me free reign of the studio and give me all the instruments, the keyboards, because I was a multitasking musician. Whatever I felt musically, whatever song came to me at the time, I might feel a funky song. And if I feel a funky song, I'm going to write it on the bass. I got to put the bottom in because that's the funk. That's the bottom right there, you know, because I'm already the drummer. I got the drummer inside of me, you know, so I got to get that bottom. I got this funky bottom, and that's what I do with my funk songs. But then when I get sweet on them, I go to the keyboards. You know what I'm saying? When it's popish, I'm on a rhythm guitar, but you know, or country or whatever. Whatever the feeling may be, I would change up the instrument to write the song. And Norman knew that and didn't discourage that in me. See, I used to work with other producers that would always tell me to do one thing at a time. Only do one thing. You're a singer, just sing. You're a singer, just sing. Don't try to do other things. Just sing and do what you're told. But I always had a hard time doing that. So Norman Whitfield was the person that let me fly, let me soar and grow. And at the same time, criticize me and you know, look at my work and tell me, you know, this is a check and this is an X. You know, get rid of this, do this. Well, you know, I like the raw Sharon Brown. You showed me your technical skills in the studio, Sharon, but personally, you're really, really at your best as a raw singer, a raw vocalist. So you need to put the rawness back into your tracks. And because I started learning how to multi-track the backgrounds, and so, you know, I would sing all my backgrounds. And when I was with CBS Records and the songwriter for Blood, Sweat, and Tears, when I sang background on a song that I had written, co-written with Hank Cosby, who was the producer for Stevie Wonder over at Motown, and he was my early mentor. And recognized the spirit in me because, you know, he gave me no problem whatsoever. I walked into the CBS recording studios in New York City and, you know, had nowhere to go and just walked in, and a security guy was at the lobby, and it was a black security guy. And I said, you know, my name is Sharon Brown. I'm a singer-songwriter. Can you tell me who's in the building? And he said, well, yeah, there's some people upstairs. I said, are they famous? And he says, yeah,
let's cut to the chase. Right?
Yeah, that was a curse and a blessing at the same time. We'll tell you about that later. But at any rate, okay. I asked a question, and he says, yeah. And so I said, well, you think I could go upstairs and take a peek in? He said, well, I'm not supposed to let anybody in like that. You don't know anybody here. You don't have an appointment. I said, yeah, well, how am I going to get to know anybody if you don't let me get to meet somebody? That's why I came to you. You know, and he started laughing. He says, all right, well, you just don't act up, and I'm going to let you go upstairs. You go up to the second floor, and you'll find some people up there recording. I'm not even going to tell you who they are. I said, okay, thank you very much. I won't disappoint you. So I walked in the elevator. I went upstairs to the second floor and heard the music, and the door was open to the studio, and I walked in, and I looked, and I saw this black guy sitting at the controls. At the board, and he turns and he looks at me. He says, can I help you? And I says, hi, my name is Sharon Brown, and I'm a singer-songwriter. He started laughing. He stopped the session. I didn't know who was in the booth. A bunch of white guys. That's all I saw, a bunch of white guys. And I said, okay, I wonder who that is, right? So he started laughing. He says, guys, fellas, wait a minute, take a break. Come in here. I got Sharon Brown out here, singer-songwriter. Just walked in. So they stopped the session, and they came out, and so you're a songwriter, singer-songwriter. I said, yes, I am. And what do you do? What if, you know, who you work for? What you, you know, I'm new here. What y'all need some singers? You need some song? What you do? You know, come on, let me hear what's going on. So the producer says, Hank Cosby introduced himself to me, and he says, well, this is Bobby Columbia, the drummer for Blood, Sweat, and Tears. I almost fainted. I almost freaking fainted right there. I had to say to myself, keep it together, girl. Keep it together. Keep it together. I said, oh, my God. Spinning wheel people? Oh, my God. I was losing my mind. So I said, pleased to meet you. It's an honor. And at the time, I was wearing a pendant around my neck, and it was a small Star of David. And Bobby was a Jew. And he says, I see you're wearing the Star of David. Are you a Jew? And I said, are you? And he says, yes, I am. I said, well, the star belongs to me. You want to call me a Jew? I guess you can. I don't know. I can't tell you. That's not why I'm here. I'm here for music. And he starts laughing. And so the producer says, well, here, listen to this track. So I listen. He said, you think you can write that? I said, yeah. He said, have it back by tomorrow. I said, tomorrow? He said, yeah, have it back by tomorrow. Here, take the track. I took the track home. I ran back to the Bronx. I told my dad, Dad, you'll never believe what happened to me today. I walked into the studio, CBS Records. Guess who I met? I met Blood, Sweat, and Tears. And the producer, Hank Cosby, he's the one that produced Stevie Wonder. He's the one that plays the famous saxophone on all the Motown records. That's who I met today. He gave me a track, Dad. He gave me a track. He told me to write this song, and I'm getting ready to write it right now. He says, well, what's the name of it? What's the name of it? I said, Love Looks Good on You. And he said, well, get busy. And I wrote those lyrics. And if you ever look at the song, it's on the Mirror's Image album of Blood, Sweat, and Tears. It's the third cut on the A side called Love Looks Good on You. I'm singing the background, and I wrote the lyric and melody. And you'll hear in that song all of the Curtis Mayfield influence in my lyric. That was my first professional and released composition for me to hear it back. And I heard Curtis all through that lyric. And the singer at the time for Blood, Sweat, and Tears was a guy named Jerry LaCroix. Jerry LaCroix was the lead singer for Rare Earth.
I know that name sounded familiar when you said that.
Yeah, he's from Rare Earth, and he had joined Earth, Wind, and Fire. He had joined Blood, Sweat, and Tears when Powell left the group. So he's singing the lead on my composition, Love Looks Good on You, and I have the honor and pleasure of teaching him the song. And he loved it, and that's when people kept saying, you know, I should be a recording artist. I should really come out of the studio and the writing room and do it, because I would do the demos. I would do all the demos and then give it to the artist and have them, you know, learn the song and learn my phrasing. And I had such great fun with Ronnie Dyson when I did him at CBS, because CBS was having a hard time with Ronnie Dyson after the Broadway show Hair. He needed a hit. He needed to change up his style or something, and they wanted to take him in another direction. So they hired me, and I went out to California with Hank Crosby, the producer, and I started writing a complete LP for Ronnie Dyson. And I ran into writer's block, which I never had experienced before, but the first time was when I was writing for Ronnie Dyson. I was in San Francisco at the hotel, and I remember I had the music tracks playing, but they weren't speaking to me. They weren't saying anything that I could hear and, you know, in my head, in my heart, and I could grab and put a word or even a melody. It just wasn't doing it. So Hank had said, well, maybe, you know, you need some fresh air. So we got in the car, and he rolled me around San Francisco the first time I ever went down Lombard Street. And I was, like, really, really freaked out about that. That was a fabulous, fabulous experience for me, going down Lombard Street in San Francisco. And, you know, I rode around for a while and saw how the mountains and the hills of San Francisco, I started paying attention to that and seeing clouds hovering over certain areas of the mountain, and then other places there were no clouds, and rain in some places and not in others, and how God would just gave us such beauty. And those are the things that would start inspiring me. And then I went back to the hotel, and, you know, in every hotel they have a Gideon copy of the Bible. And and Norman Whitfield used to always tell me to pay attention to Smokey Robinson and, you know, stuff like that. And I would read a lot of different things, various things, all sorts of things, current events, history, philosophy, just read, because if you want to be a powerful songwriter, you have to be in touch with the planet and all that goes on. So, you know, I would read, but I couldn't quite get anything, and so I picked up the Bible, and I remember just opening up anywhere. I just said, okay, I'm just going to open up to anything, and whatever I open to, that's what I'm going to write tonight. And I opened the Bible up, and I kept flicking through pages, but the only thing that my subliminal mind would actually pick up was one driving passage, and it was, and it came to pass, and it came to pass. Came to pass. I kept seeing that. So that was the first song that I wrote for Ronnie Dyson, and it was called And It Came to Pass. And
it you know, just even as I'm listening to you and I'm hearing the history behind, you know, certain songs, it's truly amazing, because the listeners, all we know is we get them on the radio, you know, we go by them and we dance to them or sit and listen to them, or, you know, and have no idea of the history behind it. We've got a couple more minutes left in the show. My special guest today, everybody, is Sharon Brown, author of the fabulous song. You all remember I Specialize in Love back in 1982. Mega, mega hit. Two questions. What Who are some of the artists you like today, and what's next for Sharon Brown?
Well, right now, I'm working with my two youngest, my sons, and my grandson. My grandson has his rap group, and it's called the Peter Gang. He's on mm-hmm. Reverb Nation, and he's also on Facebook, and we're preparing for his release and getting him prepared to do more shows. He's done
okay.
some, and he's did very well. And then my sons, they have their own entertainment company called It's Mine Entertainment, and they're also on SoundCloud, Reverb Nation. The group is Nam Viet, that's one of my sons, and Chris J., my youngest son, he's also been doing comedy. He's on the comedy circuit as well, and he's
okay.
doing very well with that. So I'm working with all of them because they've all come to me to ask me to work in the capacity of management.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily the music producing so much because, you know, we have a difference of opinion because I'm not using profanity, and I don't think you have to express yourself musically and have to use profanity at all.
That's
it's
true.
Just not necessary. I understand where it's coming from and all of that, but I do know the power of the word, and that's something that, you know, I want to drive home to all people. The power lies in the word, and the key to life and longevity is in the water.
Well, who would you say, first I want to thank you there very much for just even taking that position, you know, that you don't have to use profanity in your lyrics. I mean, there has to be somebody that's going to hold the torch, you know what I mean, and say, okay, you know, somebody's got to lead the way. Somebody has got to say, hey, you know, I'm taking a stand. You know, as for me and my house, this is how we're gonna roll with it. And I want to thank you for taking that position because we need someone to take that position. Also, who are some of the artists that you like today, I mean, that are out there now?
Some of the artists that are out there now. Well, I bought Rihanna's first album. I thought she had great potential and promise and was going to have a great future. I stayed with that up until Good Girl Gone Bad. And I just said, okay. And then I used to pay attention to Destiny's Child when they were together and followed Beyonce.
Mm-hmm.
And Beyonce to me is one of the hardest working females out there. Her and the other girl, I forgot her name. She dances, she wears black and white, and Janelle Monáe, something like that. I'm so sorry, I'm getting her name mixed up, but I saw her perform. She reminded me of back in the day when James Brown was doing it. But Beyonce is one of the hardest working. But musically, I stay with, my funk people, and I stay with, the jazz musicians, because that is more inspiration for me.
I feel you.
It's to allow me to create new music when I'm listening to the jazz cats and you know, their improvisations and stuff like that. You know, you have to understand, I came from a jazz family. You know, my roots are jazz, not so much as what they thought was gospel. You know, it wasn't gospel, even though I went to Seventh-day Adventist school, college in Huntsville, Alabama, and started singing in the choir there, but it was a Seventh-day Adventist. It wasn't a Baptist school or church or anything like that, so I didn't stay in gospel. My roots were not there. My roots were in jazz. And I discovered funk, and I took the pledge that I pledged to funk the funk to a funk.
The whole funk and nothing but the funk.
That's Clinton. I pledged to funk till it ain't funking no more funk.
I remember. It's so interesting because even when you think about George and the power of music and the influence that it has on people, a whole generation of people back from, say, I'd say probably about 73 to 80, you know, were probably, I mean, because funk ruled black music from that period, you know, from, I'd say, 73 to 80. I mean, it was the bands. It was Funkadelic, Parliament, Kool and the Gang, the Barcades, Earth, Wind and Fire. I mean, you know, the Fatback Band. I mean, it goes Cameo and more and more and more.
That's
they ruled.
Right. Yep, that's right. That's right. That's when we were the Crown Heights Affair. You can't leave them out because, you know, quiet as it's kept during the 80s, most of the music we were dancing to was being performed by Crown Heights because they were the studio cats. They were the guys
okay.
that were doing all the festivals for all the different artists, including Specialized in Love. That is the Crown Heights Affair playing that music.
Oh, really?
Along with, yes, that's the Crown Heights Affair. And Andy Schwartz from Chic, he was doing the arrangements, and he's on the keyboard. But everybody else, the rhythm section, that's the Crown Heights Affair.
I didn't know that. I remember them well.
Yeah.
I remember them well. Sharon, I wish we had more time. It's 7 o'clock, and I knew I said an hour, but if I can just get you to just, you know, how many, let me see, what was our question? My question was, what advice do you have for the young people out here today? There are people out here that are endeavoring to go into music. There are people out here that, you know, just have ideas of becoming this, just blowing up like, you know, Jay-Z and Beyonce. What advice would you give to those who are out there wanting to get into the industry today?
Well, first of all, go to iTunes and download my new single, Give Love a Chance. I think that's the song that you were thinking it was reggae. It's available at iTunes, and you can go to TrackSource. I have Thinking of You, about 20 different mixes on there. You can go to TrackSource.com and put my name in, and all my music will come up, Family Tree, Every Road, Thinking of You, and, of course, I Specialize in Love is there. And as far as the young people today, everybody's singing, everybody's dancing, everybody rapping. What do you do that's going to make you stand out from the rest? That's what they're looking for. The ones that stand out from the rest, that's the one that's going to be named the best. And in order to do that, you got to do something phenomenal. Right now, everybody's doing the same thing, using DJs and turntables and computers and blah, blah, blah. Take it back to the old school. Take it from an old girl here. This is it. Take it to the old school, learn your craft, and get you a little rhythm section and a band, a bass guitar, a real drummer,
right.
a
That's
real
right.
bass player, a real background singer, get you a real dancer, but take it back to the days of real music and you'll make real money and you will have
and
a real career.
That's what I think was one of the appeals when Jill Scott first came out. It was like, okay, she had a band, you know, it just wasn't, you know, you could just tell that there was some work that had gone into producing her first album.
Well, that's how you do it. It takes a lot of work. It takes a lot longer. But the cake in the end is a lot better. It's a lot better. It's longevity. And you can do an album like Sade. You can do an album every so many years and just dominate the charts, dominate the venues across the globe. Make you some money for your family, you know, continue your legacy. But you got to do something phenomenal, and it's a phenomenal thing to have live musicians and you're all making music together for the people and for the uplifting of people, not for the destruction of people. That's important.
Wow, I wish we had more time, Sharon, and I just want to have put it out there. I'm going to ask if we can have you back soon to continue this dialogue because this has been fabulous. I have truly enjoyed it. This hour went by so fast. There's so many other things to discuss. I just wish you nothing but much more success in the future. Thank you for the music that you've provided us with. Thank you for the education that you provided us with today. And I see nothing but good things coming from you. Much success to you and your sons. And, you know, maybe we can talk about even having one of your or both of your sons on. We can talk to them, too. I mean, this has truly been, I'm honored to have had the opportunity to speak with you today. And hopefully we can do it again.
Most blessedly, I thank you for the time. It's been an honor. And I wish you both peace and blessings and love.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And for everybody listening again, my special guest today has been Sharon Brown, the fabulous Sharon Brown, author, singer, songwriter. I mean, she specializes in love. And you could tell through the energy that she brought today that the sister is really, really phenomenal person, not to mention an artist, but a phenomenal person, and it was truly a pleasure speaking with her today. So until next week, I want to say to everybody who's taking the time out to listen to this show today, thank you so, so very much. Tell your friends about it. Jawanza for Life, every Sunday from 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We may change the hour to 5 to 6 p.m. just to accommodate some people, because we want to make sure everybody has a chance to listen, tune in, call in. And I enjoyed this. How about you?
Yes, it was a great show.
All right. So until next week, everybody, I'm not going to tell you who I got. It's going to be a surprise, but you know it's going to be awesome. It's going to be off the chain. It's going to be off the hook. So tell everybody. And hit me up on Jawanza for Life Facebook. That's J-A-W-A-N, like Nancy, Z like zebra, A, the number 4, L-I-F like Frank, E. Until next week, see you then. I love you. Peace and think well.
Peace.